Good morning, everyone. I see everyone's getting a cup of coffee. That's a good thing. I'd like to thank you for inviting me here this morning. And I'm going to be talking today about gene editing, which really follows in very nicely from what was just covered in the last presentation. And so we actually did coordinate to make sure that we were basically complementing each other's presentations. So breeders obviously can make very dramatic changes on animals based on phenotypes and going after a particular appearance that they like. And certainly we can make changes in our domestic animals and pets. We've also got a similar story to tell as it relates to cattle. And I always think these historical images are interesting, looking at how dramatically different we can make the phenotypes of animals, not necessarily the most profitable animals, but the very littlest and the very biggest. But I think if you look over time, when we started getting serious about putting profitability into our indexes, we see a really interesting trend in animal numbers versus beef production in the United States. And so what this slide shows here is cattle numbers, which is in the blue, which is on the left-hand axis there, starting off at around about 95 million or so back in 1961. And then you see it increase over time and peak out at about 1975 and then decrease over time until it's right back now at around about 92 million head. That's not only mother cows and dairy cows, but also followers, as in calves and the whole cattle population. But what we also see over that time is beef production. And we can see back in the 1961, we were down, that goes on the right axis, down at about 7.5 million tons, and you see it kind of going in lockstep with cattle numbers over time through 1980 or so. But then we see this departure where cattle numbers are going down, but beef production is going up. And there's only one way that can happen. There must be more beef per animal. And that is basically the effect that you can have from selecting for the most efficient animals producing the most beef per head. And that, of course, to Mark's point, has a huge impact on the overall greenhouse gas emissions associated with a pound of beef. And that seems to be a very popular topic at the moment. And I always think this is a really interesting graph to look at in terms of different countries and the number of animals they have versus the beef that they produce. And so what this shows, again, is cattle numbers on the left, and there is America over on the far right with its 91 or 92 million or so cattle numbers. So that black line is 100 million, just to kind of give you a reference. And what you see is that with less than 100 million, America is producing the most beef of any country in the world at about 12.7 million metric tons. But there's some really interesting other countries in this graph, and there are two other very big cattle populations that you can see in Brazil that has up there about, 2.5 million or 250 million or so cattle, so 2.5 times what the US has, but not producing as much beef. So that tells me there's less beef there per cow than there is in the United States. And then, of course, the other country that really jumps out at you there is India, with over 300 million dairy cows, but very little beef production due to religious prohibitions. And so there are many things that contribute to the overall beef efficiency of different countries, and also things that have nothing to do with agricultural science and improved efficiencies. But it's always perplexing to me where the very efficient cattle, the dairy and the beef cows in the United States, less than 100 million, seem to get a lot of the focus when if you look at their productivity, they're actually doing pretty well. But the other countries where we have less productive beef, we really very rarely hear any discussion of the fact that India has by far the largest cattle population of any country on earth, because it's literally a sacred cow in terms of that discussion. So with that background, and I'm going to, because apparently as a geneticist it's required to show this particular slide, and so this is my equation. And for many years I've had to sit through quantitative geneticists putting up equations. I'm actually going to get my revenge today as a molecular geneticist and put up a PCR gel just to pay you guys back. But what we see is that we've had the adoption of different breeding methods that have enabled an inflection point in the rate of genetic gain. And we saw that with artificial insemination back in the 1940s through the adoption of high-merit bulls and basically increasing the intensity of use of those animals. And similarly, we've seen with genomic selection, as was outlined in the previous talk, basically a doubling of the rate of genetic gain in dairy as a result of the fact that we now can basically use those young bulls because we have a more accurate prediction at their young age. And so the question that I'm going to pose today is, will gene editing be the next inflection point in terms of our rate of genetic gain? Will it be the next breeding method that will enable us to accelerate our delta G, or the rate of genetic gain? And I'm going to take a little time to go through what I'm talking about today, because you've probably heard these terms, and I'm guessing most people don't really know what these terms are. And so basically, gene editors are just a really fancy pair of scissors. That's it. There's different names for them, and so the ones that are shown on the slide here, are the zinc finger nucleases. They're the oldest ones that we have, and they've been around about 20 years. My postdoc was using this. I have a paper from 20 years ago. So these are not entirely new technologies, but both zinc fingers and TALENs are a pair of scissors where there's actually proteins that are designed to match the DNA sequence where you'd like to make a double-stranded break with your pair of scissors. And so they're not as versatile as the very sexy and often described CRISPR-Cas9, which has kind of taken the world on by storm, because rather than designing proteins that will target a specific DNA sequence in amongst the 3 billion base pairs that make up the bovine genome, you can actually tell your pair of scissors, which is known as Cas9, that's the green blob, to go to a particular location using what's called a guide RNA. And that guide RNA is just a piece of RNA that matches where you want your pair of scissors to cut. And what that means is one protein, known as Cas9, can be targeted to many different locations in the genome using different guide RNAs. And it's a lot cheaper to make a guide RNA, like literally $40, versus the proteins that were required for zinc fingers and TALENs. So basically, expensive pairs of scissors, inexpensive pair of scissors is the difference. And what do we do when we have a pair of scissors? We make a double-stranded break. And our DNA does not like to have a double-stranded break. Our chromosomes are meant to hang together. And so when there's DNA damage, as happens with a pair of scissors, or if you go outside in the bright sun without sunscreen, or unfortunately if you drink too much alcohol, you induce these double-stranded breaks and the cellular machinery tries to repair it. And most of the time it will repair it going down that left-hand side of the pathway, which is shown here. It's the non-homology end joining pathway. And you've basically got your DNA and the cell just does its best to stick it back together and crosses its fingers that it didn't introduce a mutation. And most of the time it doesn't, but sometimes it does. So you'll get maybe a single base pair deletion or a single base pair insertion, which, if you understand the way that kind of DNA works, if you introduce a frame shift so that the DNA is no longer getting translated into the correct protein because you've basically dropped a DNA base and you've messed up your triplet coding for the amino acids, you can basically knock out a gene. You turn it off because it's no longer being produced correctly. So that left-hand side of the pathway is exactly analogous to spontaneous de novo mutagenesis, which is the actual basis of all our selection programs. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have genetic variation in order to be able to select more productive animals. And so that's basically, nature's been doing that for a long time, and that's the basis of all variability. We now can introduce this in a very targeted way. Or we can go down the right-hand side of the pathway, what I call the homology-directed repair pathway, where we provide what's called a donor template that has sequence homology to either side of that cut site, and it will help the repair process. And what will happen is you'll get an incorporation of that blue DNA through homology-directed repair. And that blue DNA, which could be as simple as changing a base pair from an A to a T, which might alter the amino acid that gets incorporated in a protein and does some function that you want it to do. It might be that you incorporate an allele from one breed, like Angus, into a dairy breed, like Holstein. Or it could conceptually, be DNA, a donor repair from a different kingdom, and you could produce a transgenic or a traditional genetically engineered organism using this technology. And so depending how that double-stranded break repairs, you can be as simple as knocking out a gene, as nuanced as introducing an allele from a different species, or as different as introducing DNA from a different kingdom, like plant kingdom. So that depending how that works is kind of how that goes down. So what's on the table here, and I think this table won't last very long as a single table over time, is what, to date, researchers have been able to do using genetic editing in cattle. So that's a very narrow little group. So there's lots of work getting done in many different species, but this is just for cattle. And what you can see is that the targeted trait or goal is in the middle line there, and you can see that the overall kind of drive of our selection programs haven't changed. Our breeding objectives have remained the same. We're still interested in disease-resistant animals. We're interested in productive animals. We're interested in trying to go after some welfare traits, but our overall objectives haven't changed. And so what we just go down the list there, there's trait like not having horns in dairy cattle, and I'll talk a bit about that because my lab's involved in that, introducing an allele that gives animals heat tolerance, increased lean muscle yield, elimination of allergens, elimination of prion protein that's associated with mad cow disease, improved meat tenderness, resistance to mastitis, bovine respiratory disease, tuberculosis, a lot of disease resistance, and then all male offspring or infertile animals. And you might go, why would I want an infertile animal? And I'll get on to that because actually that whole approach to doing what's called surrogate sires, I think, is a really fascinating opportunity that exists with these technologies. So there's not a lot of traits that have been addressed so far, so let's have a look at some of them. One of them is tuberculosis, which is obviously a zoonotic disease of global dimensions. It's been spreading, as you can see, quite dramatically in the UK, and that's kind of over time from 1986 to 2010. It's actually thought to be being spread by badgers, which are those little guys there. And so there's really interesting debate amongst people that really like badgers and people that really don't like TB as to whose rights get to prevail in the UK. And wouldn't it be cool if we just had resistant animals and then we wouldn't have to make these kind of decisions? And to me, I think that introducing disease resistance using genetics, I realise I'm a geneticist, so I have my own cognitive bias, is the best way to approach disease because then the animals don't get sick in the first place. That's better for the animal, better for the farmer, and there's no need to use antibiotics. And so I think the disease resistance applications are kind of a win-win for sustainability and actually a relatively easy topic to discuss as to how you might use this technology. Another one, and one that I've been involved with, is introducing the allele from animals like Angus, the polled allele, into breeds that don't have the polled allele, in other words, breeds that normally grow horns. And this is work we're doing in conjunction with a company called Recombinetics, and Cornell Alliance for Science put together a video that I think nicely explains this for the general public, lays out what is the problem we're trying to solve, what is our current solution to that problem, how genetics could be used to let people kind of do the weigh-up of the trade-offs as to whether this is a better approach than what we're currently using. So let this video tell the story. Okay, I think we need to get the volume turned on over there. We had this running earlier. Yeah, it's not me, it's the volume isn't on over there. Sorry, I need to get back to that spot. Oh, there it is. Thank you.
Widely accepted way that the disbiting procedure is done here routinely is we will administer a lidocaine block. And a lidocaine is a local anesthetic, similar to what you might get at the dentist's office for a procedure that might be painful. And then we use an electric dehorning or disbiting instrument that provides a heat around the horn bud to fill the salve and throw the horn.
That's what that is. Okay, I'm pushing the wrong button.
All of the Holstein genetics is still in place. What we've basically done is it's a very precision technique of just introducing one trait that we want, which is polymorph, and we haven't altered the rest of the genetics.
With the change in technology, it looks like that we can achieve the goal of cad forms without a form and not have to give up the genetic capabilities of animals. So it looks like a win-win situation. Set up very productive, efficient dairy animals, and now...
Sorry. Oh. Well, sorry about that. It won't happen again.
With the change of technology, it looks like that we can achieve the goal of having calves born without horns and not having to give up the genetic capability of those animals. So it looks like a win-win situation. We set up very productive, efficient dairy animals, and we now have the opportunity or possibility of no longer needing to be horned or just by dairy calves.
Now I have to do it. Sorry about this. It's not behaving. All right. All right. That's got it running. So we developed that video for a general public audience, because many people don't know that we disbud animals and why we disbud animals. But one of the things we were also interested in looking at, and this is the work actually of Macy, who's standing down the back of the room here, is what would happen if we could use this technology to introduce polled into the dairy cattle population, and how does that compare to the alternative where we actually do have some polled genetics in dairy cows. And so long ago, there was an introgression probably from a beef animal. And what we can see here is that on average, the animals that are homozygous polled with the naturally occurring allele are on average about $150 less in their net merit value as compared to the homozygous horned animals. And so generally, producers understandably don't use those animals because they don't want to take that hit in basically $150 net profit in their offspring. And there's only very few bulls that are available. If you look, there's only 3 Jerseys and 19 that are in the NAAB catalogue versus thousands up in the elite genetics. And to what was being discussed earlier, there's these very advanced programs that are accelerating the rate of genetic gain, and you don't want to go backwards $150. But what we found is, and I live in California, we have this habit of introducing legislation that mandates that you have to do certain things for animal welfare. And so what would happen if actually we were required or mandated to use polled genetics in dairy cattle breeding programs? And so Macy actually did some modelling on that, and this is kind of shown in these three graphs. What we see here is the green is just the status quo, so nothing changes. Everybody keeps about business as usual. The horned frequency is going to stay really high because we're going to use those elite animals. The rate of inbreeding is going to click along at a certain rate as it does every generation. And the change in net merit is going to go up over time because we're selecting the best animals. And basically this slope is what we see in terms of the rate of genetic gain. If they said, okay, you've got to use polled sires, we don't really care about the fact that they're quite inbred, we would have a dramatic decrease in the frequency of the horned allele. So in other words, all the animals would be polled by 20 years. But if we had to use that little nucleus of polled animals, we'd have this huge increase in inbreeding. And to Mark's point that variation is a breeder's friend, and if you have a really big increase in inbreeding, you're basically taking away your future possibility of genetic improvement because you're becoming less genetically diverse. And obviously, because you're using less elite animals, then you basically slow down your rate of genetic gain. But if we could edit the top 1% of our bulls, that is the next generation, we can put them polled into them, we can decrease the allele, we can not have the big increase in inbreeding, and we can have the same rate of genetic gain. And that's really, I think, where the opportunities lie to integrate this into the dairy cattle breeding programs. And so that bull, the young bull that you saw in the slide, has since matured, and he was actually raised at Transover, produced by Recombinetics. He came to Davis, and we bred him, his homozygous poll, to some horned Herefords at UC Davis. And I feel a bit embarrassed talking to a beef cattle audience. Shockingly, polled is dominant, and all his offspring didn't have horns. So that's exactly what we would have predicted if anyone's ever mated an Angus bull to anything. But here's three of his offspring here. And basically what the edit was is in Holstein, the polled gene, this is upstream of the coding region, has this 10 base pair sequence that's replaced by this naturally occurring, it's actually a duplication, where that 10 base pairs is replaced by that 212 base pair sequence. So that allele, that naturally occurring allele, is what makes animals polled. And basically, if you inherit that, you're not going to grow horns. And we had five males that were born and one female, and the female, whose name is Princess, has been quite popular with the press, and she actually was on the cover of Wired magazine, but she looked a bit scruffy, we thought, so we did her up for her cover shot, and there she is just before Wired magazine came. So, you know, we're out at the beef ranch, and this van pulls up, and there's four people get out to take a photo. There's the photographer and her assistant, and then the director and the director's assistant, and you can see them here lining her up, getting her ready for her cover shot. So this is her 15 minutes of fame with the photographer getting her just so. And there she is. And she looks kind of a little bit scary looking to me, a little bit kind of sinister. She's actually quite a nice cow. And that's what she looked like on the cover of Wired. She has these kind of bulging veins and things. And that's what she actually looked like. And so that's what happens in the media. And I was feeling kind of bad for Princess because, you know, that was in all of the shops in the airport. But then I turned the page and I saw the picture they did of me, and I thought, oh, okay. So I'm just going to whip out my archangel wings at any moment here. But anyway, that's how it goes. But we've had quite a lot of interest in these animals and have done a lot of outreach with them because I think with genetic engineering or GMOs, we didn't have a good public discussion. And so here we are at picnic day, and I think this is actually science, you know, communication in action. And we basically had his Princess with a horned control. That was basically a Holstein animal used on a horned Hereford. So that's her half-sister. And we took a group of people that come to a thing called Picnic Day at UC Davis. So these are mostly Aggie alumni, so fairly well educated, in my opinion, but from California, so there's that. And we asked them what they thought about using genome editing for this purpose. And we actually had the students, so here's Macy and there's another grad student, talk about this from their perspective as students and the research they're doing. So the first student spoke about the pain aspects of removing horns, and then Macy spoke about how you could solve this using genome editing. And we did a before and after survey. And so we wanted to see what was people's opinions of this, and were we able to change that discourse by providing some information. And so I'll just show you two slides that kind of wrap this up. Basically, we've got on the yellow is the before and the blue is afterwards. And this is a question that I think is kind of funny. So what percentage of animal products like milk, meat, and eggs currently come from animals that have been produced using genetic engineering? And the correct answer to that question, Mark, is zero. That's right, right there. And so at the beginning of our talk, in this fairly well-educated audience, not necessarily animal science alumni, we had only five of the respondents get that right at the beginning of the talk, and then very concerningly as an educator at the end of the talk, where we had actually said there are zero approved products on the market, we only had 26 get that right. We still had the vast majority that think they're already eating genetically engineered animals, which I thought was kind of interesting. But the next one is really the guts of it, and that is, how do you feel about the use of genome editing to address an animal welfare concern? And what you see is both before and after, we had about 88% of the respondents at this event strongly or moderately supportive of using genome editing to address an animal welfare concern like polled. Now, you might think that's a fairly biased sample because it's at a land-grant university with our alumni, but actually a paper just came out last week that says that they were polling another group. This is actually, I believe, in the UK. And in conclusion, many participants reported positive attitudes towards GM polled cattle and suggest people may be more likely to support these technologies if they're perceived to benefit the animal. So that's encouraging news from the public perception perspective. We've got that sorted. We'll tick that box, no problem there. Actually, some of the problems to implement this in a routine fashion is technical complications of actually reducing this to practice on scale. And I just want to go over kind of how we go about doing this. So this is kind of the two approaches you can use to do genome editing. You can either do your editing in a somatic cell and clone that animal, which is kind of what Mark alluded to earlier, or you can edit in the developing embryo. And so let me just walk you through here. So here's an oocyte donor. It might be, in Mark's case, his elite animals. Or what we do is we just go to the slaughterhouse and get ovaries from dead cows, and we produce oocytes. And then we can either go one of two ways. We can go down the left-hand side of the pathway, and this is our slaughterhouse ovaries would do this. We'll enucleate take the DNA from this particular female out of there, and then we'll have a somatic cell line that's maybe from an elite animal that we've introduced, polled, or whatever we're trying to do. So we do our gene editing in this elite animal, and we'll move the diploid nucleus over into this animal, put it into a surrogate dam, and 9 months later we'll get our target, which is a homozygous non-mosaic edited animal. So this pathway looks really short and simple and easy, but cloning's not trivial, and Transova does a great job, but there's some inefficiencies here as to whether you can actually get this all reduced to practice. And you're also working on an animal line that's already in existence, so whatever that was the source of this somatic cell. The other approach is you go up this way and you basically do in vitro maturation of the oocyte. You use the DNA from the female, inseminate the egg, produce a zygote, and then you do micro injection or a cytoplasmic injection of your editing reagents in this developing zygote at the one cell stage. And then at 7 days of age, you can put that into a surrogate dam. And if a miracle occurs and you get really lucky, she might give birth to a homozygous non-mosaic animal. But more realistically, she's probably going to give birth to a heterozygous animal where some of the cells are edited and some of them aren't. And then you have to basically do breeding and go down this quite extensive pathway to eventually end up with a homozygous non-mosaic animal. And so these are all, it's not entirely trivial to introduce this technology into breeding programs, but obviously if this is an elite AI dairy bull, for example, once you've got that, then you can produce semen that takes that trait throughout the place. And so if we're going to go down the cloning pathway. What we can do is build on the graph that Mark showed earlier, where basically in his case we were taking a bunch of embryos, putting them in a cow, collecting them back, developing fibroblast lines. So maybe we have 100 embryos. We select the one that got lucky, that was the best, and then we would take that through to the fibroblast stage, and then we could edit that best animal. So we're editing that next generation, sequence to confirm we got what we wanted, then we would go ahead and clone just the same way we did in the previous example, but now we're actually cloning edited animals, and we'd end up with high merit genome edited calves at the end of the day. So this end of it, if everything goes well, doesn't add a lot of time to our breeding cycle, because if we're going to do this, we can't slow down the rate of genetic progress in our traditional breeding programs. It has to seamlessly integrate or else it's not going to be adopted. And so that's one way. The way that we've been really working hard in our lab is trying to actually introduce the edits in the developing zygote. And our big challenge there is trying to develop non-mosaic, in other words, homozygous edited animals, so that we don't have to go through that breeding out to homozygosity. And so this is a picture of microinjection of a developing of a zygote. And what we've done is developed a method to do biopsy of that zygote. And we can actually utilize, here's my payback to the quantitative geneticist, we can actually use PCR to identify the gender of the animal and whether or not, in our case, we're trying to get a homozygous knock-in. And so basically, these down here show whether it's a boy or a girl. So if you're single band, you're a girl, and a double band, it's a boy. So these two animals here, there's a boy and a girl, and they are just wild-type control. And basically, unfortunately, this went off the top, they basically have this little band here that's about 520 base pairs if there's no knock-in. In this case, we're trying to knock in a 1.8 kb piece of DNA. And if we're successful at doing that, then when we use these primers, instead of getting a 500 base pair sequence, we'll get a 2.3 or so base pair sequence. And we can see that here. So here's the control, and here's a homozygous knock-in. And we can see, so here's a male and female control, a male and female homozygous knock-in. And there's a couple of confirmatory PCRs we do with the purple primer here that'll give us a band only if there's a knock-in. And so that's what that is there. And that this green one is going to here. That'll give us a band if there's a knock-in. And these ones in the middle have both bands. So they got knocked in, and they also have some of the non-knocked in. So that tells me that they're either heterozygous or mosaic. And that's really not the type of animals that we would like to transfer. The only ones we would really like to transfer are those homozygous non-mosaic animals. And basically, the way that this would work in a production system is we'd fertilize the eggs, we'd do the microinjection, we would inject the editing reagents, confirm that we got a knock-in by doing a biopsy and then freezing that 7-day expanded blastocyst. We'd do our PCR and we'd identify the animals that were homozygous knocked in and of the gender that we were after, and then only they would be transferred in embryo transfer to a surrogate sire to produce a homozygous non-mosaic edited animal. And that's quite a lot of manipulation there. And so it does require advanced reproductive techniques to make this system work. But once you've got that animal, obviously you've got what you need. And there's been some modeling that's been done by Roslin Institute looking at if you were just using genomic selection, this is your rate of genetic gain over time. And then they modeled introducing one edit that was associated with an edit that controlled a quantitative trait, so it actually, which is a bit of a rare beast. So basically, a lot of the traits we're interested in improving are not single gene traits like POLD. They tend to be things that are controlled by many different loci, but these were quantitative geneticists doing modeling, so they had these different edits from 1 through 20, where just by promoting those edits that were associated with improvements in these quantitative traits, they could actually improve the rate of genetic gain quite significantly if they were able to integrate that into breeding programs. And so, I mean, to me, I think of editing, I'm a little bit like Mark. I see it as sprinkling the top dressing on. It's a little bit of a cherry on the top of a breeding sundae. And so Nothing about our traditional breeding programs is going to go away because of editing, but what it does do is introduce the ability to introduce useful alleles without linkage drag and also to bring in useful novel genetic variation from other species. And I guess I'm just going to talk about this one application which I think is really tantalizing in terms of how it might change breeding programs. And so this is an example in pigs where this pig over here had been genome edited to basically knock out the gene associated with germline development. So that's now an infertile boar. And he's had, in this case, spermatogonial stem cells transferred into him from this donor male, such that now the semen that this boar produces is from this animal. And so when he's mated with this female, obviously these are the offspring of this animal, even though he was the one that did the mating. And so this is called surrogate sire technology. And you could imagine in cattle, for example, where you might have situations, and I'm thinking of Northern Australia, for example, where you would like heat-adapted cattle that maybe are carrying genetics for Angus, for example, in their testicles. And so you could take, for example, a heat-adapted animal and basically use genome editing to knock out that germ cell line and then take the very best animal of whatever breed you would like to be delivered to your animals and go through, establish embryonic stem cells, do the genomic selection in the same way Mark alluded to. You could go ahead and edit it if you needed to, introduce polled or heat tolerance or have bulls that produce males only, and then use these embryonic stem cells from this bull to basically complement the germ cell deficient males of this breed. And at the end of the day, with germline complementation and transfer, you would have this guy at the end of the day, an environmentally adapted Brahman, for example, with basically carrying the testicles or the genetics of this animal. And that basically allows the use of AI, if you will, using natural service by putting the very best genetics in those natural service bulls. It removes that genetic lag associated with the top of the breeding pyramid and the bulls that are going out and doing the work in the field. It's a little bit science fiction-y, but that's actually, I think, one of the really interesting potential applications of this, if we can use it. And I have to talk about this because it's the bane of my existence, is that the regulations that are being proposed for the use of this technology in America are incompatible with its use by both research faculty and the industry. And it's 180 degrees opposite from what's been proposed for the regulation of genome editing in plants. So Secretary Perdue issued a statement in 2018 saying that if you could have produced those plants using traditional breeding, then you're not going to be regulated any differently to traditional breeding. So in other words, if you introgress an allele from a sexually compatible species like Angus into Holstein, you could have done that using traditional breeding, but you get all that genetic drag that would come along with that. But it's not introducing an allele that couldn't have come through traditional breeding. So in the case of plants, that wouldn't be regulated as a GMO. It would be just treated like a normal plant breeding program, and it wouldn't trigger the GMO regulation. And so that was exciting news when it came out. However, in January the 18th, so a day before the current administration took office, there was a draft guidance that came out from the FDA saying that they're going to consider all gene-edited animals, genome-edited animals, whose genomes have been altered intentionally by humans to be new animal drugs. And so I'm standing there with those two bull calves that have the polled allele in them, who on January the 17th of 2017 were just polled bulls, and on January the 18th were unapproved animal drugs that no longer would be able to go into the food supply, and we would have to do a multi-generational safety evaluation of them and their progeny to show that the new animal drug was safe for its intended purpose, which I guess is not having horns, and that it was stably transmitted from generation to generation. And to me, that is not a risk-based scientific approach. The regulations are in place to basically balance risks with benefits, But this regulation is entirely triggered by the process that was used to introduce this. And so in this picture, we've got some Angus in the background there carrying exactly the same allele that these two bulls have. They can go in the food supply, but those two bulls can't. And consequently, we're actually in the process of now incinerating all of their offspring because we're not allowed to let them go into the food supply. I don't need to tell you how expensive it is to actually physically burn cattle. That is actually what I'm doing, and that's not very smart. And I think if you look at the overall genetic complexity of our animals, the Thousand Bull Genome Project, which is a bit of a misnomer, they've basically sequenced somewhere in the vicinity of 2,700 bulls. They literally see 86.5 million different genomic alterations between perfectly healthy bulls of different breeds. That's nature doing its editing, and that isn't regulated. But if I intentionally introduce one, then I'm subject to a multi-year regulatory evaluation, which is just totally incompatible with cattle breeding or pig breeding or any breeding as it relates to animals. And that makes it so that animal breeders are regulated with this mandatory pre-market approval process through the FDA, where if you used modern molecular techniques, you are going to be regulated as a new animal drug. Whereas plants, they say, did you do anything that couldn't have been done using conventional breeding? And if the answer is no, then you're not subject to any additional regulations. So plant breeders can use it, animal breeders can't. And this actually, we had some good news from the administration last week. There was a presidential executive order that came out basically saying that not only the Secretary of Ag and the EPA, but the Commissioner of the FDA has to use existing statutory authority as appropriate to exempt low-risk products of ag biotech from undue regulation. What that'll actually end up looking like, I don't know, but that's certainly a step in the right direction, and there's many groups that have been working hard to get this in place. But the reason that I think this is important for this group is that other countries are taking a much more scientific risk-based approach. Canada, for example, has a regulatory process that's triggered by product risk, not by what breeding method you use to produce your product. And if there's no novel product risk, then it doesn't get regulated. And I don't think that not having horns is a novel product risk. I'm pretty sure we've been consuming that for quite a few generations. And so Recombinetics has formed an alliance with CMEX to actually introduce this elite polled, the polled allele into elite germplasm in their breeding program. What will happen with the semen of that in terms of trade is anyone's guess, but I kind of know how farmers are, so I have a hypothesis what might happen. Argentina has said that if you are not introducing a novel combination of genetic material, so you're not introducing transgenic DNA, in other words, if you introduce poll, that's not novel, we already have that in cattle, that would not trigger additional regulation. And so long as your final animal is clean of the transgene, you're not going to be subject to GMO regulation. So I can use this technology in Canada, I can use it in Argentina. Brazil just came out and said that they're not going to regulate poll specifically as a GMO. In other words, they're just going to treat it like a regular breeding. So they're not even going to keep track of them because there's nothing different about them. So, and then, of course, Australia, I get to make a little bit of fun of Australia, they aren't going to regulate it if you go down the left-hand side of the pathway. So, in other words, you're not using a template to repair the double-stranded break. But if you go down that right-hand side of the pathway, the homology-directed repair, where you use a template, then you would be regulated as a GMO. And so, basically, polled will be regulated as a GMO, but if you knocked out a gene or turned off a gene, you won't be regulated in Australia. So that's kind of a hybrid one. Doesn't make a lot of sense, but anyway, I can make fun of it because I'm Australian. But template-guided is basically the trigger there. And then, of course, the EU, who always has to do this on steroids, has said that all organisms are genetically modified if you basically use this technology because it's modified in a way that doesn't occur naturally. And they included all mutagenesis in that, but then they exempted mutagenic techniques that were in existence before 2001. So if you use radiation mutagenesis to introduce literally thousands of breaks throughout the genome at unknown destinations, that's not going to be regulated because that was in place before 2001, but anything gene edited is going to be regulated as a full-on GMO. And so this is what we have now. And to me, it's like just throw a coin, whether you're regulated or not, as to which country you're in. But it's going to provide this really interesting opportunity for countries that have more sensible regulations that are based on risk instead of process or, you know, human intention, whatever that means, will actually be able to use this technology. And so there'll be an interesting question that's put to the developers. Do I risk it and go to Brazil and develop something down there and then try to import that back into the US, or what's that going to look like? And so there's a lot of opportunity, I think, to work with these, especially South America seems to have very sensible approach to this technology. And of course, they have a really big cattle population, as we showed on that earlier slide. So I think there's some real opportunity there. And I'm just going to finish, if I may, with a short video that my lab group put together. And I'll finish with it. First of all, just genome editing offers an approach to precisely knock out undesirable traits and introgress desirable traits in food animal breeding programs. It opens new opportunities to address a lot of different things like animal welfare and disease traits. Currently, this patchwork of proposed regulatory approaches is really problematic because it's unclear what that means for trade. And then harmonising the regulations is going to be really essential in my book because it's going to put developers in a really difficult situation if they're not allowed to import meat, milk, eggs or semen and eggs in from one country to another. And so you know that my lab does a lot of outreach, and it's not often that I get the opportunity to embarrass multiple graduate students sitting in the audience at the same time. And so I'm going to take advantage of that opportunity to play a video that one of my grad students put together to talk about how excited they are about the opportunities of using genome editing in agriculture.
I got this laser inside my skull. I see them cells too red when I turn it on. All through our research, we make our cuts. We're letting genes go with it, what we might achieve. I got that white bed in my pocket. Got no lab shoes on my feet. We let through all innovation every time. Ooh, I can't take my hands off it.
That's on YouTube if you'd like to check it out. Thank you.